Hi, I'm Willow Belden, and you're listening to Out There, the podcast that explores big questions through intimate stories outdoors. One quick announcement before we get started today. We make this show for and because of you. And in order to keep making it better, we would like to know a little more about you. So we put together a listener survey. I would love for you to fill it out. Everyone who completes the survey will get a discount code for Out There merchandise and will be entered into a drawing for some sweet gear. We've got a pair of Smith sunglasses to give away, plus a Hydro Flask tumbler, and a special Out There care package. To take the survey, just head over to our website, outtherepodcast.com. Thank you so much in advance.
I don't know that I remember the very first time that I spoke with him, but I have a first time in my memory in the hallways where they had these posters of all the previous productions from student theater groups on the walls. So I think we were vaguely aware of each other, but we ran into each other, and I just remember something like him realizing that I was Turkish, which terrified me because I knew that he was Armenian, and I didn't really have any Armenian friends at that point. I think he said something like, "Oh, Ersin, you're Turkish." I was like, "Yeah." And then he's like, "You know I'm Armenian, right?" And I was like, "Oh, shit, where is this going to go?"
And I had been told by more hardline Armenians that Turks are bad, they deny the genocide. When I met Ersin, and I learned he was Turkish, I felt a level of discomfort, but we hadn't had any sort of concrete discussion about history or anything like that. So eventually, at some point, it came up, and, you know, we quickly established that at that point, what he said was he did not believe that there was an Armenian genocide, and we kept our distance.
Today, we have a story about our beliefs, about things we're brought up to know to be true. Beliefs so strong and powerful that they shape the identity, culture, and attitudes of an entire nation. We all have stories like this, stories we've been taught our whole lives. But what causes a person to begin to question those narratives? This episode is about what happens when you're faced with a truth that contradicts your own. The episode first aired on the podcast Kerning Cultures, which is a show that dissects the complex narratives of the Middle East through stories. Producer Jackie Sophia has the story.
So it all started when I was talking to this guy.
My name is Rafi Wartanian.
This is Rafi, the Armenian American that Ersin bumped into earlier.
Or an American Armenian. I don't care which comes first. Some people care very much. I'm okay with either.
But this is Rafi now, over a decade later since that awkward run-in with Ersin, the Turkish American.
Sorry. We're having an interview in here.
Oh my God, I'm sorry.
That's okay. It's typical of this house to be interrupted. So welcome to an Armenian household where there's no privacy at all.
Your mama is like, what's going on in the closet?
She's very shocked.
Oh, and that's Rafi's mom finding us in a closet, recording this interview.
That's okay.
Rafi's family, they're exactly how he pictured them. They're warm and inviting. Their home felt just like the homes I'd been ushered into in the Middle East. You know, people you've never met before end up introducing you to their entire family and insist that you stay for coffee. The smell of food cooking in the kitchen as soon as you walk in, everybody giving you a hug and a kiss on the cheek, and sure enough, Rafi's mom offers me a fresh baked roll and coffee. We sit at the kitchen table as she slices vegetables and talks about Beirut, where she used to live.
My family, my parents are both born and raised in Beirut, Lebanon, and their parents came from Eastern Anatolia, which is Eastern Turkey today.
Okay, just to clarify, because you'll hear this name, Anatolia, referred to a few times. So basically, Anatolia It's a piece of the larger Ottoman Empire that kind of juts out from the western side of modern-day Turkey. Okay, back to Rafi.
So on my mom's side, my great-grandparents are from a village called Zara, not the clothing company, actual town, in north-central Anatolia. So my great-grandfather, he sort of left behind the largest source of information that we have about, you know, our families.
Rafi's great-grandfather, he didn't just leave behind information about his family. He left behind pieces to a much larger story that's actually come to be one of the most politically contested disappearances of human life in the 20th century. Over the course of history in the Ottoman Empire, Armenians had actually been targeted for quite some time. Beginning on the eve of World War I, the Armenian population of the Ottoman Empire plummeted from 2 million to less than 400,000. A lot happened between this period of time that we'll talk more about later, but for now, here's some of what Rafi learned growing up. Armenian men in the Ottoman Empire were being targeted village by village. They were either enslaved, killed, or were worked to death. Women and children and the elderly were being led as caravans into the Syrian desert. And all of this was under the direction of the Ottoman Empire. Mardiros Balumian, Rafi's great-grandfather, he was a teenager at the time, and he managed to escape one of these caravans. But even though he escaped, he gets caught again, and then enslaved. And he's forced to transport grain and supplies to neighboring farms, but he's also forced to bury the bodies of his fellow Armenians, mostly women, young girls, and children. And after 4 years, Mardiros manages to escape again. After he returns to his family's home in Zara and finds out that nothing's left, he eventually makes it to Latakia, Syria, to a refugee camp there. And he starts a family while living in the camp. And he'll be in that camp for 10 years before he finally gets a job in Beirut, Lebanon, working as a road contractor paving roads. Rafi's parents, they both grew up and met each other in Beirut. They got married, and around the time of the Civil War in Lebanon, they ended up moving to the U.S., to Baltimore, Maryland. I wanted to talk to Rafi's parents. I wanted to ask them about what it was like to be the children and grandchildren of Armenian refugees. And I wanted to know how they feel about Turks today, but they didn't want to go on tape. And it's understandable. Now, there's another side to this whole story that we haven't heard yet. So we're going to start it here with Ersin. So Ersin is the same guy we heard earlier in the beginning of this episode.
Oh, Ersin, you're Turkish. I was like, yeah. And then he's like, you know I'm Armenian, right? And I was like, oh, where is this going to go?
He's Turkish-American. His parents, both from Turkey, came over to the U.S. in the 70s when really violent protests and communist versus fascist strikes were essentially shutting down university campuses in the country. And in order to finish school, his parents, they immigrated to the United States. I got to talk to Ersin over the phone a few times, and our conversations were pretty long, more than an hour each, and he told me he never really had the chance to tell his story, that he was nervous, but also that he wanted to talk about it and for people to hear it.
There were a lot of discussions about politics and about history, of course, at my house. Both within my family and among our family, Turkish family friends living here. Like, oh yeah, well, you know, Armenians were the favored people.
And they had a lot of contact with the West, a lot of education, a lot of money, etc., that the poor Turks didn't have.
For example, people will say things like, how could Armenians possibly have been that discriminated against when Mimar Sinan, architect Sinan, was the greatest architect of the entire Ottoman Empire's history. Explain that to me.
Mimar Sinan, he was a very famous architect in the Ottoman Empire, and he was known to have an Armenian background. The relationship that the Armenians had with other Western nations, it gets kind of complicated here, but what it boils down to is that, according to what Ersin learned, For decades, Armenians were a privileged minority in the Ottoman Empire, and they had certain alliances with Western countries and the Russians that didn't include the Ottoman Turks.
And so what I learned growing up, you know, there was this legitimate military measure taken to deport Armenians en masse from eastern Anatolia because they were all collaborating with Russian forces and to move them into Syria.
And so what Ersin learned from a Turkish perspective was that in the process of this whole deportation, right, a variety of unexpected events happened that just killed hundreds of thousands of Armenians while they were trekking to Syria on their way out of Anatolia.
You know, raids by Circassian and Kurdish irregular forces and highwaymen, and also the outbreak of influenza, and, you know, just very poor logistical planning. But wherever there was a strong Ottoman presence, that's where Armenians were best taken care of, and they fared the best.
So imagine being a little kid. And when you're little, most of what you know, it's pretty limited to whatever your parents tell you, right? And your parents have told you this one story your entire life, you know, your entire childhood. This story about your ancestral home, about where they come from. But it's not the same story that everybody around you has been told. And guess what? Some of the kids at school, they're growing up with this other story. And in that story, they see you as someone entirely different.
There would be, for example, somebody in my school was Armenian, or somebody was, say, Kurdish or something like that. And, you know, they would learn that I'm Turkish, and then they would, you know, call me like a rapist, or call me a maniac or a murderer or something like that. The genocide myth, as it was put to me, is like this glue, this binding force, and it causes a huge amount of resentment and hatred among Armenians of Turks. And so I better watch out, and I should steer totally clear from that, or else I might be the target of that hatred. Combined with kind of what my parents taught me about being Turkish in America, that we are a kind of weird minority in that there's very little visibility. We are very passable as white. And so nobody thinks, oh, this is a minority that has minority-like issues. I was kind of raised with a sort of a sense of paranoia that I should be careful about who I reveal my identity to, because you never know. There might be somebody from a neighboring country from the old lands, right, the old world, who might cause some trouble for me.
So Ersin, he gets older, and eventually he goes off to college in Baltimore. He becomes a humanities major, which brings us back to this moment, to the dimly lit hallways behind this theater on campus, where Ersin sees this guy walking towards him.
Yeah, I think it was sometime pretty early. I would guess probably fall of 2005 on campus. And there are these just like kind of hallways crisscrossing the bottom of the theater. And I remember that I was walking somewhere like for a show that I was in. And then this guy just like sees me, and it's Rafi, but I didn't really know him at that point. And he's like, hey, I heard that you're going to be on the 4K with me, and you're Turkish, something like that. And I was like, oh my God, what's going on?
And I had been told by more hardline Armenians that Turks are bad, they deny the genocide. And like, I didn't quite understand. I didn't have a ton of experience and knowledge. So when I met Ersin and I learned he was Turkish, I felt a level of discomfort. Eventually, at some point, it came up, and, you know, we quickly established that at that point, what he said was he did not believe that there was an Armenian genocide. But that lots of Armenians had been needlessly killed and it was terrible what happened, but the word genocide is very debatable. So that made me very uncomfortable. And I told him that, and we kept our distance.
But then the Forte happened. It's a cycling team that bikes 4,000 miles across the United States, from Baltimore to San Francisco, every year. The 4K for Cancer, it's a nonprofit that raises awareness and funds for cancer research and treatment. And over the few years since it started, it's become a pretty well-known thing around campus. People who sign up for it fill out this long application saying why they want to do it and prove that they'd be able to put up with a grueling schedule, which isn't just physically exhausting, but it's also really emotionally and mentally exhausting as well. Riding every day for 2 months with not much else to keep you occupied except your bike and the people you're riding with.
I saw a poster, a flyer, and I just remember that it was saying, like, want to ride across the country and all this stuff. And my initial reaction was that that is just crazy. Like, that's bad crazy. Who the hell would do that? And then I thought, oh, I would do that, actually. So as I dug into it, you know, obviously the cause was an important one. And in my application, I wrote about my grandmother having cancer. But I think if I'm being really 100% honest, the biggest motivator for me was just to go on a big adventure.
So Rafi and Erson both applied to be part of the team. And as luck would have it, they're both accepted. So people accepted onto the team, they're expected to do community service in the months leading up to the ride. With 25 other teammates, these two guys were doing things like making dinners at a local care residence for cancer patients who were being treated at the nearby hospitals in the city.
Yeah, I mean, we would interact at Hope Lodge. I think we were in the same circles in general in terms of drama and theater. But knowing me around that time, I probably felt pretty intimidated and worried that, like, because of my background, that Rafi hated me or something like that.
In the early morning hours of a late spring day in 2006, only days after the end of the school year, Rafi and Erson, they join the rest of their 25-person team on campus. Duffel bags are crammed into the back of team vans, bikes are tuned, and they ride down as a unit to the Inner Harbor, 2x2. There's a small, almost obscure ceremony, and the riders dip their tires into the water of the harbor, and then they head west.
Like in the morning, you get up and you're like, wow, what the f*** am I doing? Where am I? And who are these people? I felt in general very nervous about riding with people, just like the physical proximity of my wheels to their wheels. And there were so many near-death moments where I was always like, I don't know, there was always this sort of tension for me of it was an environment that was where emotional closeness and intimacy was fostered through a certain kind of physical intimacy, the physical intimacy of sport. So we get up in Nevada at like 3 a.m. to beat the heat or whatever. And, you know, people would sort of straggle up and there would be some kind of breakfast somewhere. People would be sitting together eating breakfast. There's a lot of socializing going on at that point that I often didn't take part in. I always remember these circles. As we're getting ready to actually hit the road, we'd have these circles where everybody would gather in a circle and talk about who they were dedicating their ride to that morning. People would feel free to talk about something that was important to them that they had on their minds about that day and who they were dedicating the trip to. And then people would break out into groups, and it definitely felt like, you know, there were some groupings and like kind of cliques and whatever of people who tended to stick together. And then I would always feel nervous and be like, oh, I don't know who to ride with. I felt like everybody was in on a joke that I wasn't in on. It felt a little exclusive.
I just always remember feeling like, you know, I was one of, I think, 3 freshmen on that trip, and everybody else was either a sophomore or an upperclassman. And so I felt very isolated.
which is not their fault, actually. I was a very different person at that point in time, and I think I had a lot of anxieties and phobias and stuff like that that I don't really have anymore. So I wasn't really able to socialize the way that I wish I could have.
So about 2 weeks into the ride, the team is at a water stop. And Arison, he's on the phone with his family, probably his mom or his dad.
Okay, I love you. Bye-bye.
And something happens.
I overheard his conversation with his parents on the phone.
Here's Rafi again.
And I would hear him say things that sounded familiar. I hadn't quite figured out yet how it all worked, but our dialect of Armenian has a lot of Turkish, Arabic, and French in it because these are like the colonial powers that Armenians pass through. They're borrowed words as part of the dialect. So he would hear me say things that were Turkish, you know, words that were Turkish.
If I was talking to my mom, I'd say, Anne nasılsın, which means, Mom, how are you? And to my dad, I'd say, Baba nasılsın, Dad, how are you? Beniyim, I'm good.
We started talking about how our parents had very similar personalities and how the cultures, you know, the Turkish culture he came from, because his parents were from Turkey, and the culture, my family's culture, had all of these very quirky qualities that were pretty funny to think about, you know, as we're biking along, you know, talking about you have to marry a Turkish girl or an Armenian girl, and you have to, you know, just all the social norms that we sort of disagreed with or questioned, we found a lot of common ground.
Rafi was somebody who didn't give a f-. Like, he just didn't care about sort of social pretensions and, you have to act this way or that way. He was really just very creative and always kind of being silly and artistic.
A lot of our interactions just would be after we get to the wherever we were going, and would, you know, we bonded a lot over like jokes that we would make, or sometimes like little pranks.
We would make these dumb songs about the trip and then play them for everybody, and it kind of became a well-known duo. So I think that it became pretty evident very quickly as we progressed in the ride in an organic fashion that there was no need for any kind of tension.
And so they keep going like this, right? Biking, writing songs, biking, composing, biking, mixing. Then playing the songs for their audience, which is really just their teammates. Most of the songs are based on inside jokes between the teammates, and honestly, if you listen to them, you don't really get it sometimes. Or it might sound a little raunchy. Some of them are pretty raunchy. But you can also tell they're all in really good fun.
There was this guy, David Luongo, who was built like a truck. I think he lives in Colorado now. And we always kind of looked up to him as like one of the badasses of the trip. And then he said, Bamf's in the back. And I was like, what's a Bamf? And he's like, a badass mother. So then we made a song called Bamps in the Back. There was a lot of production quality going on, given the fact that we just had his MacBook with no external mic or anything, and we're in, you know, the middle of nowhere half of the time.
I think that what set me at ease is just Rafi, just his natural sort of bursting forth of energy and positivity. And that is something that, you know, it's hard not to engage with that. So those other elements, I think, were still present. But overall, those were not the dominant elements in our relationship.
They pass through towns of less than 1,000 people. They ride through downpours and up mountains. There are some close calls with trucks. Someone breaks their hand. A couple people end up leaving the ride before it even ends. but eventually they do end up in San Francisco. They cross the Golden Gate Bridge on the last day, and they dip their tires into the Pacific Ocean. There's hugging, maybe some crying, and then they get onto a plane and go back to Baltimore. But they didn't just go back to their regularly scheduled program.
I was a history major, and although my subject had nothing to do with the Middle East or with Turks or Armenians, being friends with Rafi made me think, well, I should do some research about this, right? I thought that I would go out and do my own research. And I think I even remember asking Rafi for some help, just like some sources that he recommended, some books that I should read. And I started to read some more from the Armenian perspective.
I tried to seek out, like, what is the scholarly Turkish opinion, for example, on the, say, an issue like the Armenian Genocide. I realized that actually the amount of scholarship from the Turkish side, like, I had expected that, oh, there's a ton of scholarship out there from the Turkish side. It's just not well publicized because everybody is kind of like, it's a taboo. But the truth is that there's really almost nothing. Like, there's a few articles from the 90s and the 80s here and there, most often done by amateur historians inside of Turkey.
There's so much like loaded with the word genocide. And especially when you consider, like, sometimes I wonder whether Armenians are aware, or the community in general are aware, that most Turks fully accept that, like, hundreds of thousands of Armenians died. And the consensus among professional historians about the Armenian genocide is like the consensus among professional scientists about climate warming. I mean, there are some out there who are skeptics, but I mean, overwhelmingly, right? And this was always sort of dismissed by the Turkish side as just politics, right?
So honestly, this kind of confused me. Like, how can someone deny that this happened, but also admit that it did? So on the anniversary of the Armenian Genocide this year, which is April 24th, I came across this article in the New York Times. And the article was titled, "Sherlock Holmes of the Armenian Genocide Uncovers Lost Evidence." The article talks about Dr. Taner Açım, a historian who managed to find what he called, quote, "the smoking gun." And it goes on to give this play-by-play, right, of how Dr. Açım and his team, they discover this document. It's a telegram, and it was typed up in a secret code from a high-ranking official in the Ottoman Empire to a colleague of his asking about information on the, quote, "killing of Armenians in eastern Anatolia." It's a pretty exciting discovery because most of the documents that the Turkish government supposedly had at the time that were evidence of an organized Armenian genocide, they disappeared after World War I. Supposedly, they were destroyed. But apparently, this document was with a bunch of other boxes that the Armenians, who were in Istanbul at the time, shipped to England for safekeeping in 1922, right before the Turkish nationalists were about to take over the country. From there, the documents take a route that's straight out of a Dan Brown novel. They were kept by a bishop in the UK, then later went to France, and then Jerusalem, and they stayed in Jerusalem where they were kept in an archive. And they haven't budged since the 1930s. No one seems to know why, but they can't be accessed by scholars. However, Dr. Açım did find photographic evidence of the document, and he found it in New York, of all places. There was an Armenian monk who was living in New York, and he's since passed away, but he was a survivor of the Armenian genocide. And his nephew, he kept the photographs that his uncle took of the documents while he was in Jerusalem. And it sounds like this incredible story, right? This long-lost document gets found in this crazy international chase of sorts. But then the article quotes this other guy, this other historian, an Armenian by the name of Dr. Bedros Dermatosyan. And he says, quote, "denialists will remain denialists." He just kind of waves it off, like it doesn't matter what they found. Which seems strange, you know? At least, it seems strange to me. So, I went looking for another source.
My name is Ümit Kurt. I'm a doctor. I am an adjunct professor at Clark University and postdoctoral fellow in Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Harvard University. In elementary school and middle school and the high school, I was indoctrinated, educated, and trained like a Turkish, ideal Turkish teenager who firmly believed the, you know, supreme identity of being a Turk, this Turkish pride. I never heard the word genocide in my life until the university, my universityhood, let's say.
So I asked him, what do you think about denialism? People who deny that 1.5 million Armenians who died had nothing to do with an organized genocide. Like, do you think what Mirtosyan says is true? And so I assume that, okay, he's a historian. He'll think documented evidence, it plays a pretty big role in convincing people of something they refuse to accept as true. Like, if you can somehow get that person into a room and put this evidence in front of them and make them look at it, they'll change their minds.
Denialism in Turkey is based on the consent and the support mechanisms of the society, Turkish public, not only state. So, you know, this, of course, denialism is like, it's a continuous process and it's inherited by one generation to another. So, it has become a culture.
What do you think it takes for, you know, the average Turk to change their perspective?
You can make studies, you can develop on, you know, this subject matter in order to bring more and more proof. But that is only beneficial for the researchers, for the scholars, for the public who are interested in the issue. But for denialists, that's futile. That doesn't make any sense. He's gonna or she's gonna deny it anyway. You know, that's why I can't see any point to bring the proof in order to change mentality of the denialist. Someone can do that, but I wouldn't buy that argument. You know, that's my point of view. The problem of denialists has nothing to do with demonstrating them proof, okay? Since there is a plenty of proof, there are numerous proofs out there. They don't have a problem of acknowledging it. That's the issue, you know.
But then, what is it? I mean, what is it that's actually going to change someone's mind? What changes the way we think and feel about something if it isn't going to be hard, fact-based evidence?
Documents are means, you know, are tools. We are talking about, first and foremost, a mass violence incident. Armenian genocide is a mass violence incident, such as Rwanda, what happened in Rwanda, what happened in Germany and Eastern Europe during the Holocaust, and so on and so forth. Don't believe the power of the document. Believe in your narrative. You know, so I believe the power of the narrative. So that's why I always go after the narrative itself.
So I talked to Rafi and Ersin 10 years after they did the 4K, and they're still really good friends. Ersin, he's married now. Right after our last conversation, he was headed out on a ritual date night with his wife, which I thought was really adorable. And he's working at a startup company in California, where he feels like he's really found his niche. Rafi, he's in LA, and he just released an album a few years ago. He composes his own music that's kind of a fusion of classical Armenian and American folk. And he's teaching guitar and the oud, and he's also working on a screenplay. And here's Rafi again.
Yeah, I saw him a few months ago. We've kept in touch all these years, and he's actually on a journey of really stripping down the dogma and the ideologies he's been told to believe and carry on, and he's felt very much misled. I don't try to push it on him. It's not my agenda to try to go and convince him of X, Y, or Z, but my interest is, you know, is first and foremost with him as a person. You know, I'm just there to support him on his journey, and, you know, likewise.
What now is the narrative that you believe in?
Now I do believe that the massacres that occurred were part of an orchestrated program of genocide, which is a pretty, I suppose this is going to be broadcast and now people will hear this. And I mean, that's a dangerous thing for me to say. But I don't care. Well, I do care actually a lot, but I also don't want to hide my beliefs. And I think it's important for people who are in my position to speak out. And that's why I say it. That's a risk to, as a Turk, to believe that, as many people have found out, you know, even with their lives.
You know, from the other perspective, from the Turkish perspective, there's so much insistence on like, well, we didn't kill you on purpose. And it's like, okay, but you accept that your actions were played a role, or that generally our ancestors were somehow involved in this tragic event, right? Then, I mean, at some point, when do we recognize that an absurd amount of blood has been spilled, and that we are all neighbors and we're all, you know, part of the same community, and that as neighbors we need to take care of each other? I mean, at some point, when do we just acknowledge the enormous amount of pain in the room? Sometimes I wonder whether it would be possible for me to be close friends with Rafi if I never accepted the Armenian genocide. That's always a lingering question for me. Sometimes I walk down the street and, you know, in the neighborhood that I'm next to, there's a big mural and it says, "You're entitled to your own truth." And then it says, "So long as your truth does not encourage my destruction or the enslavement of my will." And, you know, something, when there's a great historical tragedy, a tragic event like this, I wonder, is it really possible to move on without justice and without that wrong being redressed? You know, it's very nice that Rafi and I make silly songs together and that we can do all that, but sometimes I wonder whether that is, whether any of that would be possible unless he knew that I cared.
That story was brought to us by Jackie Sophia, a producer from the podcast Kerning Cultures. We're going to chat with Jackie and with one of the hosts of Kerning Cultures in just a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor. Support for Out There comes from Thrive Market, making it easy to get healthy, affordable food and beauty products without having to leave your house. If you're anything like me, you probably appreciate good food, but you hate grocery shopping. It's boring, it's a waste of time, you have to find a parking spot, they're almost always out of that one ingredient you really wanted, etc. Enter Thrive Market. They're an online store that sells organic products delivered straight to your door at a discount. By shopping at Thrive Market, you can save time and money. Plus, it's super easy to find products that fit your lifestyle. For example, you can filter your search results to show only vegan items or only non-GMO items. Right now, there's a special deal for Out There listeners. You can get 25% off your first order and a free month-long trial when you go to thrivemarket.com/outthere. That's thrivemarket.com/outthere. And now, on to our chat with producer Jackie Sophia and host Hibba Fisher from the podcast Kerning Cultures. Jackie and Hibba, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So tell us a little bit about Kerning Cultures. What's the focus of the show?
So we produce radio documentaries from across the Middle East. Most mainstream media in the Middle East it doesn't really speak for its youth, and it's the stuff that you hear on the radio, like listening to the radio in Dubai would just hurt my soul. And so that's why we started. And the kinds of stories that we've done, one of my favorite episodes actually is two non-narrated stories of women describing the aftermath of their divorce, one in Egypt, one in Lebanon. We've done a story following the journey of a man who's reviving specialty coffee in Yemen. And he takes you into this whole world of specialty coffee and tasting and cupping and growing the beans. We've done a story tracing the history of children's education in the Arab world through the lens of a TV show, Sesame Street, and the impact that it had in the Arab world, first in the 70s and then more recently in 2015 onwards. These are some of the episodes that we've done.
And who's your intended audience here? Who are you trying to, I mean, are you trying to introduce people who may have sort of very, very one-dimensional pictures of the Middle East? You're trying to introduce them to sort of more nuanced stories, or what's the sort of overarching goal here?
Well, our primary audience are actually ourselves. So we're telling these stories for Arabs, for Middle Easterners first. And then a secondary audience would be a non-Middle Eastern audience looking to better understand the region and looking for content that they can actually connect with. Because, of course, you know, most media about the Middle East is certainly actually across the world, whether it's in the region or outside of the region, is very politicized. And so to hear a story about a person, to hear, you know, their emotions and their feelings is a nuance that doesn't really come through. and that's what we try to capture with our stories.
What does kerning cultures mean?
So kerning is a process in typography. It's the sizing of spaces between letters in a font so that you can read a word more clearly, and so it's more aesthetically pleasing to look at. So the name is a metaphor. It's the spaces in between cultures through the stories that we tell.
I love that. It's beautiful. Hey, but tell me about your background.
I am half Egyptian, half American, and I was raised between the Gulf and the States. Kerning Cultures is my first foray into journalism, actually. So I've been working on KC now for a little over 4 years. And this has been an incredible journey, and one of the, you know, I they say it's a good thing when you can wake up every morning and you don't need coffee, you know. So I need coffee for the most part because I tend to wake up really early. But I mean, metaphorically, it's good.
So, Jackie, how did you get involved with the show?
I think for everybody who's involved in radio, they all have a story of how they fell in love with radio, right? And then somehow, one way or another, a lot of those people in radio are like, and at some point I decided I wanted to make the stories I love to hear. So for me, I mean, I listened to the radio, like NPR was just a part of my childhood growing up, and it was always on in the background. Then fast forward to, I was living in Jordan. I was working a long time with a community of Palestinian women in Jordan who are kind of classified specifically as ex-Gazan refugees, and they're pretty prohibited from accessing citizenship and most of the rights that come with citizenship. So I was really used to working alongside this community in the Middle East that was often misunderstood and, you know, most times misrepresented by the media and people from outside the camp. So when I was in Dubai and I heard from a friend of mine that, you know, there's this woman who's starting a podcast about the Middle East, and I was like, oh my gosh, I have to know her. I have to talk to her. Because at the time I was like getting into journalism more. And so I got in touch with Hiba, and she was just like super passionate about telling these stories and like just being more nuanced about it.
And how did the idea for this particular story come about?
So I guess in a story I produced with you guys without there a little bit ago, I kind of followed my journey on this thing called the 4K, which was this 4,000-mile journey across the U.S. on by bicycle from Baltimore to San Francisco. So I rode that in 2009. And for me, it was just like, it was one of the most formative experiences of my life. Part of that experience was becoming just insanely close with the people on the team. And they become your family, really. And so Rafi, actually, one of the characters or people in this story, I mean, he's a real person. Rafi and I...
Radio people always talk about the people in their stories as characters.
I know, right? So Rafi and I, and we're really still good friends today. You know, like we'll grab coffee and hang out whenever we're in the same city. He's just this like amazingly kind and talented person that I've known for a long time. And I knew Ersin, the other person in this story, when they were both part of this improv group in college. And I actually remember going to an after party one night and talking to Ersin, and I don't even remember if he remembers this, or I don't know if he remembers this, but he told me about how he was Turkish, and like him and Rafi were like good friends, and it was so interesting how like Rafi's Armenian and he's Turkish, but they're really close. And yeah, and somehow I like kept that story in the back of my head, but then like fast forward to, I moved back to the U.S. from the Middle East in 2016 after the election. I wanted to do stories particularly about children of immigrants. So I actually had this idea of like doing stories about immigrants in the U.S. and showing how like somehow we're all children of immigrants. And I just, you know, I was familiar with some of Rafi's story, but not all of it. And so I asked him if he would be willing to talk about his own experience as the child of Armenian immigrants. And the conversation just kind of naturally moved towards his relationship with Ersin.
I'm curious for both of you, and maybe Hiba, this is more of a question for you, but I'm curious what the response has been to Kerning Cultures. What kind of feedback have you gotten from listeners?
It's been amazing. Alhamdulillah, we get a lot of listeners will write into us long essays, actually, of you know how much it means to hear themselves in a story. We had an Egyptian student write in actually last week saying that since she discovered Kerning Cultures, we've transformed her shower time and her getting ready time and her walking to school time. And,
and I love how people always tell you what they're doing when they listen to your
Exactly. Exactly. Which means so much to us. We had a comment on that story we did about the two women describing their divorce. A man actually messaged us on Instagram to be like, "You made me cry at the gym, and I'm a dude." And that's the kind of response that we're getting, which I love.
What are your hopes and goals for the show moving forward?
So we have big dreams with Kerning Cultures. We're building the premier Middle East podcast network. So the vision is for Kerning Cultures to become an umbrella name, and then underneath we'll have inshallah 15 original Arabic and English shows under the umbrella of Kerning Cultures. I would love. I had this idea at the very beginning of Casey that there would be a map of the Middle East and North Africa on our website, and there'd be a pin where every story came from, so you could narrow in by country that you wanted to listen to stories, and that we'd have pins across the whole region, and work with producers across the whole region.
Well, thank you both so much. I really appreciate talking with you, and it's lovely to meet the voice behind the show, or one of the voices behind some of the voices behind the show.
It's wonderful to speak with you, Willow.
Thanks, Willow. Thanks.
Again, that was Jackie Sophia and Hiba Fisher from the podcast Kerning Cultures. We've got a link to their show on our website, outtherepodcast.com. Before you go, a quick reminder that we would love for you to take our listener survey. Knowing more about you will help us improve the show, and it's an easy way for you to help us out without spending any money.
As I mentioned earlier, everyone who fills out the survey will get a discount code for Out There merchandise and will be entered into a drawing for some really nice gear. To take the survey, just head over to our website, outtherepodcast.com. It takes about 5 minutes, and by filling it out, you will have our undying gratitude, and you'll get that wonderful, warm, fuzzy feeling inside that comes from supporting independent creators. Thank you so much. That's it for this episode. Our marketing and business development director is Alex Eggerking. Jessica Taylor is our advertising coordinator. Laura Johnston heads up our ambassador program. And our theme music was written by Jared Arnold. Today's story was produced by Jackie Sophia with editorial support from Razan Alzayani, Hiba Fisher, Alex Atek, and Percy Everlin. Sound designed by Ramzi Bashour with additional support from Lily Crown. A lot of the acoustic melodies you heard today were composed and played by Raffi. Yes, that Raffi. Some of the other songs were the actual songs that Raffi and Erson wrote during their ride across the U.S. We'll see you all in 2 weeks, and in the meantime, have a beautiful day, be bold, go outside, and find your dreams.